A young reporter has her eye on a case that could make her career.
While a veteran reporter has his eye on that young reporter. Coming up next on Out of Touchdown. Unless you're the dude, who doesn't love the Eagles? That was Heartache Tonight. And actually, I'm going to be more specific. That song is in the movie that we're about to discuss. However, it's a cover version during a scene in a bar. And I was like, you know what? The song is classic. It's the Eagles. I'm going to go ahead and run with it and let it play at the beginning of this podcast. This podcast called Out of Touchstone. I am your host, Mike DeKalb. And on the other end of the Skype line is my co-host, Chad Smart. Chad, unlike the dude, you love the Eagles, do you not?
I have seen them in concert 3 times, so I hope I like the Eagles. But I have to ask you, who did the cover song that we're not honoring tonight or today, whenever you're listening to this podcast?
Yes, the cover version was performed by David Palmer. But as soon as I heard it in the movie, I was like, oh man, that's a great song. But not the Eagles version. And sometimes it's kind of tricky to track down those cover versions. Mm. And we love the Eagles. I will always be jealous. Chad was fortunate enough to see the Eagles here in Los Angeles when Vince Gill was in the band. And I've only seen them one time many years ago with Chad. But I did not see that show with Vince Gill. All right. Well, we don't need to talk about the Eagles. We can talk about Touchstone Pictures. And the movies, well, we're now into the summer of 1994. And so you're thinking, you know, hits and blockbusters. And there's a couple that Disney put out over the summer that were huge. But of course, those were for Walt Disney Pictures, whereas the Touchstone film they put out, not so much. And hopefully we won't spend too much time on it, but I know that it was an important picture in their catalog. It was released on June 29th of 1994, and it's called I Love Trouble.
It was the kind of story that has everything. Murder. Scandal.
You and I both know this is the story of our lives.
And billions of dollars at stake.
You promised me this was going to be taken care of.
It was the kind of story any reporter would die for.
We've got a scoop.
And this reporter.
The only evidence to destroy is you.
Could get killed for. Julia Roberts, Nick Nolte, I Love Trouble, rated PG. Starts Wednesday, June 29th at a theater near you.
A little bit of a Touchstone reunion for all of the principal people involved with the film. This was the brainchild of husband and wife filmmakers Nancy Myers and Charles Shire. Of course, those names should be familiar to fans of Touchstone Pictures. They had just written and directed Father of the Bride in 1991. Their only credit since was as co-writers on the 1992 comedy Once Upon a Crime, which was directed by Eugene Levy. Chad, I think I remember seeing Once Upon a Crime when I was in high school. I had no idea that Eugene Levy, who's worked with Nancy Myers and Charles Shire, including in I Love Trouble, he directed that movie. Have you ever seen that one?
When I saw your notes, I thought I had seen it, but I'm thinking of Blame It on the Bellboy, which, you know, we reviewed here on Out of Touchstone, so that's why it's in my brain. But
oh, I see. Yeah, okay. Well, and then the lead of our film, I guess, well, there's two leads, but the first one I will talk about is Julia Roberts playing the character of Sabrina. She's returning to Touchstone for the first time since 1990's Pretty Woman. Now, she had ascended to Hollywood's A-list in the meantime with a slew of films. You know, I totally forgot. I was going to quiz you on this to see if you'd seen any of these 5 movies, but I guess I'll ask you if you saw any of them in theaters. Flatliners, Sleeping with the Enemy, Dying Young, Hook, and The Pelican Brief. I saw Flatliners. That was the only one I saw in a theater.
Well, I've seen all 5 of those, but only Hook and The Pelican Brief I saw in the theater.
Oh, man. I remember, I think we may have mentioned it on the Pretty Woman episode, but I was obsessed with her at that point. And I saw Flatliners in the theater, Sleeping with the Enemy. I don't remember it playing in Hawaii. It must have come really quickly, but I had to go to the video store when it came out. And it took a while, because every time I went, it was always checked out. And this is, you know, shows you my age. But yeah, again, she was on top of the world. And because she also had a little bit of power, she wanted Harrison Ford to star opposite her. But he turned it down, and the part went to Nick Nolte, playing the character of Peter. This was his fourth Touchstone film, after Down and Out in Beverly Hills in 1986, and Three Fugitives and New York Stories, which both came out in 1989. Now, he's very busy since, with movies like Q&A, Another 48 Hours, Cape Fear, The Prince of Tides, and Lorenzo's Oil. This was his third 1994 release, after I'll Do Anything and Blue Chips, which both came out in February of 1994. Blue Chips was a movie that I was definitely excited about. I was a big college basketball fan, and it kind of holds up. It's really cheesy, but I definitely think it holds up. All right, well, if we look at the supporting cast, everybody's in this movie, Chad. There's no other way to say it. I've broken it into two categories, one of people that had multiple scenes, and then one where people had very minimal, if one scene, maybe a second scene. The principal supporting cast, if you will, is led by Saul Rubinek, great character actor. He had just been in Bonfire, The Vanities, and Unforgiven. James Rebhorn, who was in My Cousin Vinny. He had also just done Blank Check for Disney. And Dan Butler, you recognize him as soon as you see him on screen. If you've ever watched Frasier, he played, was it Bulldog. The sports jock, right? And then, oh my God, okay, the rest of the supporting cast, there's so many. I'm going to highlight some of the key ones. I think, Chad, you said you got a couple to bring up. It starts with Robert Loggia. You know, in addition to doing the Hollywood Pictures film, The Marrying Man, he's also did two movies in the early 90s that I would recommend to anybody listening, because I have a really, really soft spot for them. And that is the Dana Carvey comedy Opportunity Knocks, and also the football movie Necessary Roughness with Scott Bakula. God, I love that movie.
Two great films.
Yeah, they're both really good. I saw them both in the theater.
Yeah,
we also get Olympia Dukakis. She's been in the Touchstone movie, The Cemetery Club. Marsha Mason, I think I saw in maybe an IMDb's trivia section. She has 1 minute of screen time. Why is she? This is an Academy Award nominee, and you stick her in the movie for 1 minute. She'd also been in the Touchstone movies, Stella, in her previous credits. As I mentioned, Eugene Levy, he had done two previous Touchstone films, Splash and Father of the Bride, with Nancy Myers and Charles Shire. We get Charles Martin Smith. I always think of him from The Untouchables. He also played Buddy Holly's bassist in The Buddy Holly Story, of course, American Graffiti. But there was one credit I wanted to bring up. Do you remember, we talked about this on our first episode, he's in one of the last Walt Disney pictures before Touchstone was created, a movie called Never Cry Wolf.
Never seen it. Don't know it. But yeah, he will always be the bass player from Buddy Holly and Tony the Toad from American Graffiti.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, lastly, the last person I had was Paul Gleason, the late Paul Gleason, unfortunately. I always think if you could put together a stretch, he had a 5-year stretch in the 1980s where he was in Trading Places, The Breakfast Club, and Die Hard. I mean, that's a good run. He's only in one scene, and you're just like, I wish there was a little bit more of him.
Yeah.
But who do you wish there was a little bit more of, Chad? You said you were someone else you wanted to call out.
Yeah, I have three other names because you have Clark Gregg, who, I'm going to be honest, I saw his name in the credits. I don't remember where he was in the film, but, you know.
He was the guy who gets on the train at the beginning of the movie.
That's right.
Yeah, he's the scientist with the briefcase or something, right?
Yeah, and he's gone on, you know, to be Agent Carter, or not Agent Carter, that's someone else, but he's Agent
Coulson
from the Avengers franchise. Yeah.
He was also in the David Mamet's crew, right? I think he did theater with them, and so he's in a lot of the Mamet films. Yeah.
And then I'll quiz you on a one scene actor. Did you recognize when they're at the train wreck and Nick Nolte spots Julia Roberts for the first time, he asks somebody, "Hey, who is that? Did you recognize that person?"
You know, I had to look it up after the fact because I believe you're talking about Keith Gordon.
I am Keith Gordon from Christine, Back to School. Legend of Billie Jean, and I know you're a big Brian De Palma film fan. He was in Dressed to Kill.
Dressed to Kill, yeah. I think I saw that in maybe it might have been in the IMDb trivia section, that he wanted to do a movie with Nick Nolte, and so he took this part, even though it was only one scene, so that he could get a script to him.
Oh.
And I saw that after the fact, and I was like, oh, I don't even remember Keith Gordon in this movie. And when I went back in to pull my clips for this episode, I was like, oh, wait, okay, he's got kind of long hair and like a bunch of facial hair. hardly recognized him, but yeah, yeah. Great Keith. I mean, I'm a big Back to School fan, so yeah, I do like Keith Gordon. Yeah.
And then the last one is one that if anybody out there knows the guy, they probably know him for one reason, and it 30 years later on, it stuck with me, but the guy who delivers the dog to Julia Roberts.
Oh, yes. That is comedian Barry Sobel.
Yes.
I recognize him immediately. We talk about it on this show, but I had, back when Comedy Central first started, and I think it was like the late 80s, it was called the Comedy Channel, mm-hmm. and they used to show a lot of like random stand-up spots. And I watched that channel a lot. And I remember, that's Barry Sobel, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. He has a part on one of the Rodney Dangerfield HBO specials. And I watched it again after watching this film. And again, it's a routine that has stuck with me for 35 years now. And watching it, I don't know why it's funny. But the crowd is just laughing. It's him rapping, basically. And, you know, it's from like 1986 when rap was and hip hop was just starting out. But mm-hmm. yeah, I would be curious to see if anybody who has not seen it, if they watched it now, if they would even like chuckle, because
that's true.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yeah. Because as soon as I saw him, I'm like, wait a minute, that's Barry Sobel, isn't it?
And I believe he was the kind of mentor to Tom Hanks on Punchline.
Oh, was it? Okay. Yeah. I could believe that. You know, can we just sit and talk about the cast of this film?
It would probably be a better conversation.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're going to get into our little segment where we more or less review the film. I like to pose it as a series of questions to you. And honestly, the first question I had was there anything redeeming about this film? Because I thought that the two leads, they definitely have charisma. They are movie stars, after all. But their chemistry was weak at best. You know, like, they each get a movie star entrance. You know, hers in that opening train wreck scene. And then he has that moment in the singles bar where, like, all these women are lusting after him. And I just thought, like, the movie definitely felt like a star vehicle summer movie, mm-hmm. and they just wasted this really talented supporting cast. I did not like this movie.
Yeah, you know, and I have seen several Julia Roberts movies, especially over the last 30 years, and I've never been like a huge fan of hers. I've appreciated her work, but I've never really cared that much. But watching this film, I'm just like, I was captivated at several points when she is on screen. She just had this. Mm-hmm. aura about her and this presence that I can understand why she became, you know, one of Hollywood's biggest stars in the 90s.
Yeah.
And Nick Nolte he's Nick Nolte. So I don't think he really goes above and beyond anything that you would expect out of him, but he's, again, Nick Nolte.
Well, yeah, that was the funny thing is that's my next question is why Nick Nolte? Because I think I saw that he had recently been named People's Sexiest Man Alive before this film. I think it was 1992. But I think he's still too old for Julia. I looked it up. This really bothers me a little bit. And I know this is common in Hollywood. But at the time this movie was made, Nick Nolte was exactly twice her age. She was 26 years old and he was 52. You know, and I feel like and Harrison Ford was only 1 year younger. So I don't know if that would have been any better. But I just, you know, he's carved out a career playing these like rugged tough guys. So it was kind of odd for me to see him as like this sharp dressed romantic lead. You know, I don't really see the pretty boy appeal in him. And it kind of took me out of the movie somewhat. Like I said, there's a scene when they're in this singles bar and Julia Roberts is trying to get close to the employee of this company, Kelly Rutherford, another great supporting cast member. And Nick Nolte walks in and she's like, and Kelly Rutherford's like swooning over him. And it's like, really, Nick Nolte? Because I keep thinking of the painter in New York Stories, you know, or you know, it's like I don't get it. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you? I mean, you just said we like him; he's a very talented actor, but in this kind of a role where he's supposed to be kind of a romantic lead.
Yeah, I guess you've got a good point. Like everything that I know, or most of the movies that I associate Nick Nolte with, he's playing kind of a. You know, not necessarily down on his luck person like he does in Down and Out in Beverly Hills, but, you know, 48 Hours, he's just this kind of alcoholic cop. I think it's really only just maybe Prince of Tides and, mm-hmm. I guess, to an extent, Cape Fear, where he's more of the professional, sharp-dressed type person. And, mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, if People Magazine named him Sexiest Man Alive in 1992, which begs the question, he hasn't died yet, so... why did he only get Sexiest Man 1 year? Like, who has come along besides Lucky Vandross? Is that his name? The Diet Coke guy?
Oh, my God. That's a good poll. I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'll fix that in post. I don't remember.
But yeah, you know, and, you know, you mentioned the age difference and, you know, just made me think of a review that I read one time about one of Richard Gere's movies where it says, you know, he gets older, his co-stars get younger. So it's just, you know, it's the Hollywood double standard that.
Yeah, Richard Gere had that silvery hair. Yeah. He was always kind of like this handsome man. I think of him as that sort of matinee idol type mm-hmm. rather than.
Nick Nolte.
He's built like a linebacker, right?
Yeah, he's built like Gerard Depardieu. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, okay, well, here's another question for you.
Yeah.
This movie is a murder mystery / romantic comedy. Could you explain the mystery? Because I sure couldn't.
When I was watching it, this was going to be my question to you that I was going to have you add to the rundown. None that I can't explain it. I just don't care about it. It is such an uninteresting plot line. And I've got no words for this because the mystery is just so, you know, it's not even, it's like it's secondary and it's just kind of like the MacGuffin that's going on. It's just, they spend so much time on it and I don't care.
Yeah. The mystery is just, it's kind of ridiculous at some point, right? Like it's like murder to cover up some sort of hormone that stimulates milk production in cows. Mm.
And causes cancer. Yeah, and then that causes cancer, and that's, you know, not good. So
yeah, I think the cancer causing part was after I turned out. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and level with the listeners right now. I got to a point, maybe the last 25 minutes, where I tapped out. Like I just like this movie got really irked me, and to where I was like, I was just going to make something to eat, and I had it on, and I was just listening because I was like, okay, I know what's going to happen, and the bad guys are going to reveal their entire plot, Nick Nolte overhears it, you know, and it was so corny. And I think, you know, with all due respect to Nancy Meyers and Charles Shire, you know, they're known for romantic comedies and they're really good at that. But as a result, they kind of spent way too much time in that first act with the relationship with Peter and Sabrina rather than kind of building up the mystery. And unfortunately, the mystery kind of suffers as a result. And I think, did you notice this as well, Chad? Like, you knew it was going to be dark because as soon as the music cues changed, then it was just like, oh, something bad. Something like, this must be a nefarious character. Or this must be something involving the mystery. And as a result, it just kind of kept shifting the tone. Like, it was light and cheery romantic comedy. And then, oh, my God, it's a murder mystery we have to solve. But then it was also an action movie. They're running from people shooting at them.
Yeah, and speaking of the music, I think I saw that Elmer Bernstein had written the score for the movie, but then they scrapped it at, like, the last minute and brought someone else in who, on a lot of the early prints of the film or of the poster, isn't even credited. It's still Elmer Bernstein. So maybe that's part of it. You know, they just didn't have time, so it just went generic movie cues.
I guess, but it was just so, like, obvious, you know. And I think, like, when it comes to mystery and comedy, I mean, maybe we've talked about it on the show. One of my favorite movies of all time is The Thin Man. Myrna Loy is my favorite actress. And I think that movie proved that you could do mystery and comedy together. But this movie got just a little too gritty. Like, I think they were also trying too hard to, like, make it a throwback to the 1940s. Yeah. Especially, I got a lot of His Girl Friday vibes from it with Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell. You know, but I think it failed miserably as a result.
That was quite a performance you gave last night.
You weren't bad yourself.
But the tears. Bravely, Academy Award caliber.
Thank you, I try.
By the way, our friend last night was a pro recruited out of South America.
How do you know?
I have friends in low places. As I said, Peterson, if I tell you what I know and you tell me what you know.
Look, Brackett, it's not my job to tell you anything. I'm your competition, not your girl Friday.
I'm suggesting we team up.
With each other?
Well, we'll investigate together, but we write separately. I mean, we'd be like the Hardy Boys, except one of us would be a girl. A woman. So, what do you think? Are we a team?
I suppose it is the sensible thing to do.
Well, we're gonna have to be completely honest with each other. No more double-crossing.
No more tricks.
Partners, 50-50.
5050.
So let me ask you this, Mike, because in pulling reviews for this film, a lot of them brought up Bringing Up Baby, which I have never seen. Have you seen it?
It's been a long time.
Okay.
I probably saw it 20 years ago. Yeah.
I guess it's a similar film where there's a crime and man and woman falling in love, which they always said, you know, that movie did it better. So, like you said, it can be done, but, and you talked about you checking out. I totally missed how they got to Las Vegas. I'm like, wait a minute, where did this happen?
Was it Vegas or was it Reno?
I thought it was Vegas. See, again, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
But I was going to say, you know, watching it, I had the knowledge that, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, in a few moments, about how Nolte and Roberts didn't get along. And I'm watching it going like, I don't really see where the chemistry is supposed to come in. And I'm like, this would be a good movie where they don't fall in love with each other. Just keep it as kind of a rival to that they have to bond together to, you know, stay alive. But they don't need to fall in love. And I think it would have been a better film. But
you know,
again,
what?
It's Hollywood.
I'm going to go ahead and throw you something even crazier. What if the movie was two guys, two heterosexual men as rival newspaper people and who had to work together? That, I think, would be even better. I mean, because I think that you want to make the romantic angle of it, but I'm like, you just have them be two intrepid reporters working on the same story.
Yeah.
I'm sure that movie's out there somewhere.
I'll even go one step further than that. Because they are two Chicago reporters, one working for, obviously, a knockoff of Sun-Times and one of the other Chicago Tribune.
Tribune, yeah.
What if it was Siskel and Ebert?
Ah. You could name them. You could just name them Roger and Gene.
Yeah.
It'd be a nice little throwback. I mean, you mentioned Bringing Up Baby. I thought of His Girl Friday just because that movie set in the world of the newspaper business. And that's actually the last question I was going to bring up is, like, the one thing about this movie that I did appreciate, you know, as much as I didn't like it, I mean, it, at least the budget showed. It was. It kind of felt like watching a big budget movie, which was kind of fun. And it was really cool to get a peek behind the curtain of working in the newspaper business. But I think, did they do the justice to the profession? You know, because it did really feel like a movie the whole time, you know, with these attempts to kind of glamorize the job or show how the reporters could be in danger. But, I mean, is it the kind of movie you would watch and be like, oh, I want to be a reporter after it? Or did you think not so much?
I think this is total Hollywood Reporter, you know, and not someone who works for the Hollywood Reporter. because, you know, I think a reporter would more likely be just phoning, you know, sources, trying to get interviews, trying to get backstory. I don't think they're actually running around the country trying to track down. And probably, you know, the story probably would have been killed after like 2 days. And the editor would have been like, no, there's nothing here. Don't worry about it. Let's move on. So, yeah, I don't think that many reporters that aren't in war zones are being chased and shot at every 5 minutes.
Yeah, it would have been a short movie. And I thought it was funny, too. There was like 8 montages in this movie, just in the first half alone. But speaking of reporters and journalists, what did the film critics that worked at various newspapers across the country in 1994 think of the film, Chad? What kind of reviews do you have for us?
Well, let me say, it was hard to just pick out soundbite since I don't give full reviews. You know, I try to get a nice 1-2 sentence structure, and a lot of the reviews were not written that way. So if these don't make sense, you can look them up for yourself to get the full review. But as we name-checked earlier, I'm going to go first with Roger Ebert. He, a Chicago newspaper writer, reviewer. So he said, "This is not a serious thriller, but a light romantic comedy. The movie is not without charm, but maybe it would have been funnier if the evil cow conglomerate had been replaced by something sillier and more lightweight. It's hard to sustain a romantic comedy in the face of death threats." 2.5 stars.
You know, I saw that review as well, and I thought that same thing. This movie would have probably worked if it would have been more comedic, right? If you just got to go more broad in that angle and make it be a silly mystery.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it couldn't have been worse, so. Karen James of the New York Times wrote, "I Love Trouble is a breezy summer escapism, and taken on those light-spirited terms, it is loaded with charm." So kind of a echoing Ebert's sentiments there. And then finally, Lisa Schwartzbaum from Entertainment Weekly said, "I Love Trouble is not trouble-loving enough, and as a result, Roberts doesn't have enough to do to stay sharp. Nolte doesn't have enough to do to stay soft. The jokes are thin, the comedy is spotty, and the elements of suspense are scattered chaotically. C rating.
I feel like sometimes movies like this, the reviews tend to be just about, hey, these are big movie stars, and it's fun to watch these movie stars on screen. Because, yeah, I mean, maybe this doesn't hold up after all these years to me. Mm. I'll let you go first, Chad. On a scale of 1 to 10, what did you think of the film? Because I'm going to bring down the hammer.
I guess I'm going to be a little bit more generous than you, because my review is pretty much simply for the actors involved, their performances, and for the fact that it has Barry Sobel in the film. He bumps it up at least 1 point. I gave it a 3. It's charming, but it's just at 2 hours, and that felt like a very long 2 hours. Trim a half hour off, make it a little faster pace. Like you said, ramp up the comedy if you're going to throw the comedy in there. I think you got a better film, but as it is, this gets a 3, which is being generous.
Yeah, I'll say being generous. I mean, I can never go down as far as 1. That's reserved for the Firebirds and Cabin Boys of the world.
Cabin Boys.
No. I came with a 2, Chad. This movie bothered, like I said, it really bothered me. It was just mediocre at every turn. You know, the casting is great, but they're wasted. The script, not so strong. I think it was just, and at a certain point, like I mentioned, it was insulting to the viewer. It was a real, real chore to sit through.
Yeah.
And I think that the point that hit me, like I mentioned a minute ago, about the last half hour or so, I tapped out. And it specifically, there was a specific scene where they're on a flight and they're sitting next to each other, and Julia is returning to her seat. And then right when she gets to Nick Nolte, turbulence hit, and then she falls into his lap. Yeah. And that's where I was like, okay, I'm done. I'm like, this, why are you forcing this on us? Yeah. Just either. I mean, I, like I said, I know you can do both, but if I bring up the Thin Man again, everyone jokes about the fact that the first 10, 15 minutes of the Thin Man doesn't even have Nick and Nora Charles in it. It's setting up the mystery. And this movie was just like, this movie's about reporters. Mm-hmm. The mystery is such an afterthought, but then it's like, it's hard to keep invested, right? If you're not even sure what they're looking into, you're just watching them.
Yeah.
And then you find out that, like you said, the main point of trivia for this film is that supposedly the stars hated each other, you know? And Julia Roberts said that Nick Nolte was the worst actor she ever had to work with. Meanwhile, Nick Nolte said it was the worst movie he's ever done, and he only did it for the money. There was an article, I think, that was from the LA Times in 1994, where I guess a publicist came out and said, oh, you know, don't believe all what you heard. But it's just like, I think as years go by, the truth does come out, you know? And I was going to ask you, I saw the film first before you did. There's a moment in the, I think it's in the IMDb trivia section as well, where it says that the stars refused to do later scenes together, so they had to use stand-ins. And I was going to ask you, when you watched the movie, see if you noticed it, because there's definitely a lot of shots like where it's just a close-up of one or the other, and it cuts back and forth between the two. And so I'm like, okay, great, you could probably shoot that with a stand-in. But all those scenes have an establishing shot with the two of them in it. And so I'm like, okay, then what did they shoot the establishing shot? And then they go, okay, we're going to do the close-ups now. And they're like, all right, I'm out, you know, or something like that. That's the only thing. I was waiting for there to be a moment where it was clearly one of them walking up to the other one, and you never see, you never see them in a two-shot, but it seemed like there always was.
Right. You know, and just to throw the other side on there as well, Nick Nolte did mention Julia Roberts' tantrums on set, which, you know, I could see at this time in her career, as she was the star, I can see maybe she did have a bit of an attitude or something that maybe rubbed Nick Nolte the wrong way, and who knows. But unfortunately, it did show on screen. And yeah, I think had I been paying more attention, had the movie been more interesting, I probably would have noticed more of the camera tricks to shoot around just their inability to work together. Mm-hmm. But by that time, I didn't care. You know, I mentioned it to you after we recorded the last episode when we were kind of previewing this off air, that I saw this movie in the theater.
Ah, man.
Before watching it again, I couldn't have told you one scene that was in this movie.
Really?
That's how much this movie stayed with me after I saw it. And again, ask me in 3 weeks, it'll probably be the same again.
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, again, Nick Nolte, talented actor. Yeah. I wonder what could have been if they would have got somebody a little bit younger. if they would have got somebody that was more of a dashing, I know you don't want to capture lightning in a bottle by putting Richard Gere and Julia Roberts together again, but someone like him, you know, I was like to look and see if there's a personal connection. We haven't had one in the last couple of episodes, but we finally did have one. It was Clark Gregg. I mean, granted, he's only in the movie briefly, but I did meet him at a screening of the film he directed called Choke, which was based on the Chuck Palahniuk novel. And that was at a screening at the Arrow Theater back in 2008. I have a copy of the wonderful David Mamet film, State and Main. Mm. And I have he autographed that as it's like a bingo card. I'm trying to get as many people from that film to autograph that DVD. Mamet's autographed it, and I did get Clark Gregg to sign it. And you know, and the funny thing was, I think we talked about in the last episode that you and I had been to the bridge from Renaissance Man where they cross into Canada, and the whole opening scene of this movie takes place at Union Station in Chicago. And I was just there. I was literally just there a couple months ago, and I recognized the tracks, I recognized the lobby, and everything too. So. I said, apparently you got a personal connection as well.
Yeah, and this one is more recent.
Is it Barry Sobel?
I wish. You know, I keep waiting for him to perform, but then I've seen videos of him recently, and he's still doing that same act from 30 years ago. Okay. But no, I was at a recent convention, and Megan Kavanaugh, who plays one of the sources, you know, the witnesses that Julia Roberts is trying to interview, she's also in League of Their Own. So I met her at a con, or she was at a convention. I walked up to her and just said, you know, I mentioned the Out of Touchstone podcast, said, we're getting ready to review I Love Trouble. She was like, cool. And then I talked about how my first professional job was shooting a Larry Bird commercial in New Harmony, Indiana, which is where they shot League of Their Own. So she's like, oh yeah. And we just kind of went, cool. Okay. And then I walked off because I don't know what to say to actors. And
you had a moment.
Yeah.
Hey, you talked to Keith Coogan. You guys are like best buds.
Yeah, well, you know, he's the Coog. I mean.
Yeah. Oh, wow. What is the legacy of this film? Obviously, this movie, I mean, you know what? This movie could probably be stood to be remade if you just tweak a few things. But when you look back 30 years later, to me, I feel like the legacy of this movie is basically how not to make a summer movie. You know, and we'll get into it later when we talk about, did this fit Touchstone's ideal of singles and doubles? But it seems like, it was a misfire at so many different steps. I mean, it's a shame that they, you know, they cast two people that weren't going to end up getting along, but like you said, no chemistry, bloated, you know, high budget, which is fine, but then it was such a mess. And then it was kind of put out right around July 4th weekend as well. And I don't know, it doesn't seem to be what Touchstone should be dabbling in. And I feel like years later, people really only know it because of the notoriety it has about the fact that Julia Roberts and McNulty hated each other, right?
If they even know that. And
that's true.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's one of the ones that you could ask people and they probably wouldn't recognize it unless they are a Julia Roberts fan, because I'm sure the McNulty fans probably don't even remember it either. Yeah. And then any final thoughts on the movie before we move on?
Just please, let's not even bring this up in the Ronnies for 1994, because I don't want to have to remember the movie when we get to that point. I just want to forget it again, as I have for the last 30 years.
Yeah, like I said, there's probably a good movie buried in that plot. But when the whole time I was watching it, especially toward the end, it occurred to me that this movie might be Touchstone's Ishtar.
I say don't besmirch the name of Ishtar with that, because Ishtar is not that bad of a film. It just didn't have an audience.
But just the sort of the notoriety.
Notoriety.
Like Waterworld or something. Ishtar immediately came to mind.
You know, I was just thinking, you know where I'd be today if it weren't for you?
No, tell me.
At the Beverly Hills Hotel. On my book tour. Lounging around the pool, giving interviews, gazing at starlets.
You're not even embarrassed to say that, are you?
Embarrassed? What do you think? I'd rather be traipsing through poison ivy wearing a shirt on my head looking for hidden test results?
You think they're hidden?
You're actually having fun on this story, aren't you?
You're not? I mean, I understand you're saying you're not, but you're really not?
Peterson, do I look like a man having fun?
A man lounging around the Beverly Hills Hotel ogling starlets looks to me like a man not having fun. And furthermore, I think you owe me an apology. In my opinion, meeting me was the best thing that ever happened to you. You could have quit this story anytime you wanted, and you didn't. Because you and I both know this is the story of our lives, and no matter what you say, I know you'd rather be an ace reporter than a second-rate novelist.
All right, we'll spend the second half of the episode looking at a couple of other movies that Walt Disney Pictures released right around the same time. The first of which is just one of the classics of the genre, one of the biggest hits the studio ever had. It was released on June 15th of 1994, and it's called The Lion King.
From Walt Disney Pictures, he was the heir to a vast empire.
This will all be mine?
Everything the light touches. Until a treacherous plot cost him the throne.
I will be king!
No!
But while his life may have changed, his destiny could never be denied.
You are the one true king.
I'm going back!
Simba!
In the great tradition of Disney adventure, comes The Lion King. Rated G. Exclusive engagements now playing. Starts June 24th everywhere.
All right, there was a lot of people that had a hand in making this film. I always try to look at these movies by who wrote it and who directed it. Well, you got two directors, you got three people who were given screenplay credits, and there's 26 additional people who got some sort of a story credit. So, yeah, and I know that I was reading a book recently that said Jeffrey Katzenberg was totally involved with the development of this. Roy Disney was involved. Everybody was in it. So the two directors that get the credit for co-directing the film are Roger Allers and Rob Minkoff. They had both worked for Disney Animation, and only Rob Minkoff had any directing credits. He had done the animation scenes for a couple of Roger Rabbit shorts. The three screenplay credits go to the following writers, the first of which is Irene Medchi. This was making her feature debut. She'd just mostly written for television. Jonathan Roberts, who was the co-writer of a couple of the 80s comedies, The Sure Thing and Once Bitten. He'd also written several episodes of Beverly Hills 90210. And finally, we have Linda Wolverton. She had written a lot of animated TV shows in the 1980s. Then she wrote the screenplay for Beauty and the Beast. And most recently for Disney, she did the Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey film, which came out in 1993. The premise for the movie, I mean, it's simple. It's Hamlet in the jungle, right? It's a young lion prince who comes of age and faces off against his angry uncle who has unjustly ascended to the throne. You know, you got a very stellar cast. I'm going to kind of gloss over, or at least point out some of the ones, especially the ones who had other Disney credits. You know, the young Simba is voiced by Jonathan Taylor Thomas, JTT. He was really only done Home Improvement at that point, produced by Touchstone Television, by the way. While the older version of Simba was played by Matthew Broderick. Jeremy Irons plays Scar. I realized Jeremy Irons and Matthew Broderick, none of them had ever done a Disney film before this. Yeah. We had the legendary James Earl Jones, who plays Mufasa, Simba's father. Chad, now's my chance to give you a little bit of a trivia question. I just looked it up. I Love Trouble is the 80th Touchstone film that you and I have watched for this podcast. James Earl Jones was in two Touchstone films. I defy you to name either of those movies.
I'm going to say Offbeat and Hello Again.
No.
Cabin Boy.
No.
He should have been in Cabin Boy.
One of them, he actually has a cameo playing himself.
I got nothing.
He was in the 1991 comedy True Identity as himself. But okay. The other movie that he played, where he actually played a character, he plays the detective chasing after Martin Short and Nick Nolte in Three Fugitives.
You never go full Marty.
Yeah, right. As soon as I saw them, wait a minute, James Earl Jones. That's how some forgettable some of these movies can be. I mean, True Identity was fine. Three Fugitives, but yeah, James Earl Jones in a couple of Touchstone movies. Also in a Touchstone movie was Moira Kelly. She had been in the movie Billy Bathgate. She does the voice of Nala, which is Simba's best friend and later his queen. We get Whoopi Goldberg, Sister Mary Clarence herself. She plays one of three hyenas that are helping Scar. And I think I quiz this to you. I think you're going to know this one. But both Timon and Pumbaa, the great side characters, I think that's pretty much the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of this movie, right? They had both been in Touchstone films. Nathan Lane was just in Life with Mikey in 1993. And Ernie Sabella was also in a Touchstone movie. Chad, do you remember which one it was?
Saved by the Bell, The Beach Years.
Oh, Mr. Carosi. Mr. Carosi.
Yes. I believe it was Tough Guys.
Tough Guys, 1986. Yeah, he plays the clerk at the hotel where I think it's Kirk Douglas or the... Yeah, Burt Lancaster's in the nursing home, right?
Yeah.
Kirk Douglas is in the hotel. Ernie Sabella is the hotel clerk. Our thoughts on this film, Chad, how can we spend too much time talking about this movie? It's a classic. It's a compelling story with stunning animation. I'm just going to guess that the majority of people that are listening to our show have seen it. If they haven't, they really need to see it.
Yeah, when we were prepping for this show, you mentioned you didn't want to spend a lot of time on Lion King. And I'm like, we don't even really, I don't think we need to talk about Lion King, because either you know it or you are under the age of 5 or have been in a coma for 30 years. It's one of those three. And I will just say, avoid the live action remake. Yeah. Just stay with the animated. There's a reason why animals are animated. But yeah, this is, you know, just, I mean, go pop on the soundtrack right now. Watch the movie. It's, again, it's The Lion King. I think that's all I need to say.
Yeah, and we joke about it before, but the live-action Lion King is part of the impetus for this podcast, because I was wondering, why is Disney doing that when they could be making movies like the Touchstone Pictures? Mm-hmm. You know, when we kind of did this reformat where we wanted to look at some of the other movies that Disney was putting out at the same time, I really wanted to see movies like Blank Check and Iron Will. You know, I'll be honest with you, I did not rewatch Lion King for this episode. I've already seen it. It was more about getting into like the box office and seeing what Touchstone movies would come out on the same time as the Disney films. So we don't need to share our thoughts on Lion King. You know how good it is. I did want to add one more note. You mentioned the soundtrack as well. The soundtrack for The Lion King hit number one on the Billboard album chart, and it is the highest selling soundtrack of all time for an animated film. You know, Chad and I used to do a podcast where we talked about one-hit wonders, and we were always dissecting the Billboard Hot 100 chart for singles. And Can You Feel the Love Tonight reached number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100, while Circle of Life reached number 18.
Wow, I did not realize that it had been that popular, and now I'm kind of sad, because that means The Little Mermaid is not the highest grossing or biggest selling soundtrack animated film. But I'm just going to say, Mike, I think we can, you know, end this discussion with just two words. Hakuna Matata.
It's a wonderful phrase. Well, Disney did have one more movie that came out in the summer of 1994, which also fared much better than I Left Trouble. It was released on July 15th, 1994. It's a movie called Angels in the Outfield.
From Walt Disney Pictures, they were a team headed in the wrong direction.
Boy, they're bad.
Until a young fan wished for a miracle.
Maybe you could help him win a little.
And got an angel.
Holy cow!
No one can see me or hear me, buddy.
Here we go again.
I really do see something.
This summer, there's magic in the air and angels in the outfield. Rated PG. Starts Wednesday, July 13th at a theater near you.
This was a remake of a film that was released in 1951. The remake itself was written by Holly Goldberg Sloan. She had just done the 1993 comedy Made in America, which I think we talked about on this show, because it seemed like it was in the box office against a couple of Touchstone films, the Whoopi Goldberg Ted Danson comedy. The film was directed by William Dear, who had a couple of credits that I wanted to call out. He did Harry and the Hendersons, and he also directed a movie that I saw in the theater. Love it. If I saw it again today, I would love it just as much. And it's the Richard Grieco spy thriller, If Looks Could Kill. Please tell me you've seen that one, Chad.
I don't think I have. I think we keep talking about having a screening of it, but no, I've never seen it.
Oh, my God. He plays a American high school student who goes to France on like a summer trip, like as a foreign exchange student. And then people think he's a spy. And it's great. I mean, it was right at the height of his Booker 21 Jump Street fame, I guess. Richard Grieco. But as far as Angels in the Outfield, to bring it back, the plot is, it's a sports movie, sort of, also a family inspirational movie. It's about a young baseball fan who's in foster care, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who had just done the Hollywood picture film Holy Matrimony. He prays to the heavens that his favorite baseball team will win the pennant and bring his absent father home. A group of actual angels, led by Christopher Lloyd, Touchstone veteran for Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they assist the lowly California Angels and improve the team's fortunes. Another great supporting cast. We get, you know, Danny Glover is the team's manager. Tony Danza is the veteran pitcher. Both of them were making their Disney debuts. In addition, we get two Oscar winners who were Oscar winners at the time. That's Brenda Fricker, who had won for My Left Foot, and Ben Johnson, who had won for The Last Picture Show. I don't want to go too far on the deep end with Ben Johnson, but I will tell you, he's clearly based on Gene Autry, who was the owner of the Angels, the movie cowboy. Ben Johnson, legendary cowboy. He won, like I said, he won his Oscar for The Last Picture Show, but he is one of the stars of the movie that inspired me to go to film school, which is Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. As soon as I saw him in the movie, I kind of lit up. It was so great to see him. But we also get a group of many, many Disney returnees, I'll call them. J.O. Sanders, there he is again. He was in
Old Cement Head.
He was in Mr. Destiny and My Boyfriend's Back for Touchstone. He was also in the Hollywood Pictures film V.I. Warshawski. Chad, I know you love the supporting actor Tony Longo.
Yes, I am glad you put him on the list because I was going to bring him up. He is unfortunately passed away about 10 years ago, but yes, he is one of my top 10 character actors.
Yeah, he was first in 10, right? Wasn't that, yeah. Is that where he kind of got was known for? He'd been a couple of Touchstone movies, Splash and Mr. Destiny. He was also in The Marrying Man, the Hollywood Pictures film. And the two future Oscar winners that are in this movie, who have both already been in Touchstone movies. We get Matthew McConaughey. He had been in My Boyfriend's Back, of course. And then Adrien Brody. I totally forgot. Adrien Brody apparently has this uncredited part in New York Stories. I don't remember where he was. But, Adrien Brody, Matthew McConaughey, both in this film. Chad, I'll kick it over to you. What are your thoughts on Angels in the Outfield?
I had not seen this until watching it for this podcast. And I'm going to put it in the same category as Disorganized Crime, a cast that I'm like, this is a great ensemble cast, and the movie was disappointing. I mean, I enjoyed it, but there was something missing. And, it's sports film. You know, you have the sports formula, and you know that the ragtag team is going to pull together and win, but I didn't see any real conflict in the film. And J.O. Sanders is the play-by-play announcer who hates the team. And I don't, I'm trying to remember, like, was he the manager and got demoted? Like, why does he hate the team so much? And really, there's no real conflict with him hating the team. It's just like, hey, I'm going to hate this team. And
Disney films need a villain.
Yeah. And
There's no villain in this movie. Basically.
No. And sitting here thinking about it, at one point, why didn't we get Tony Danza going, hey, Angel, I'm over here, Angel,
Is that a Who's the Boss reference?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, you mentioned it's sports movies, it's formulaic, but I love sports movies as much as anyone. Baseball films can usually be pretty enjoyable, but this was strictly for kids. And I think that's the kind of the issue that I have, is that some of the sports film, like the actual logic of the sporting event makes no sense. There's a scene where a guy gets a base hit, and then the Angels spin the ball around, and so the guy keeps rounding the bases, and it's like, okay, it's the kind of movie that, like, I'm sure people saw it at a young age and loved it. Maybe they became baseball fans afterwards, but seeing it as an adult, it doesn't quite hold up. I mean, like I said, it's got a great cast. It's watchable, but it's not memorable. And, it has a lot of those shenanigans that you see from a Disney film and some really goofy characters. I called out two more great character actors from the cast. Neil McDonough, who plays like this dim-witted pitcher, and then Taylor Negron, who plays like the publicist for the team. And it's just every time they're on screen, they're doing something kind of silly. And, I kind of tuned out a little bit, but it was fine. It was fine. Did you happen to see the remake, the 1950, or the original 1951 film? I think it's streaming on HBO Max.
It is not, unfortunately. No, it's not streaming anywhere, so I could not watch it. But real quick, I want to give a shout out again to Taylor Negron, another great character actor who is no longer with us. One of my favorite, again, top 10 list of character actors, and totally off topic of this show, but do you know his musical connection?
Uh-oh, put me on the spot. I got nothing. What you got?
He is the cousin of the lead singer of Three Dog Night.
Okay.
Chuck Negron.
Right? Yeah, okay. I didn't put two and two together. Well, the last little footnote I had on Angels in the Outfield was that the premiere of the film was held at Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh during the festivities for the Major League Baseball All-Star Game that year. And interestingly enough, Pittsburgh, which was the original 1951 Angels in the Outfield, was about the Pittsburgh Pirates because the California Angels did not exist yet. Unfortunately, the movie came out in the middle of July, and the Major League Baseball strike of 1994 commenced 1 month later.
So. Oh, bad timing. Real quick, you and I live in the Los Angeles, Anaheim area. We have been to Angel Stadium many times. Movie not shot at Angel Stadium. Did you know that?
Yeah, it was shot at a stadium that you and I had also been to, which is the Oakland Stadium. Yeah.
But I found a quote from Matthew McConaughey from 2011 when he was talking about Angels in the Outfield. And this is in Cigar Aficionado magazine. He said that he thought he was really making the big bucks after his Angels in the Outfield acting gig. I was getting $48,500 just to act and play baseball. I would take that too. Although, would I in today's economy? I don't know, but still.
All right. All right. Well, as we go into the conclusion of the episode, let's look at the box office, because this is where Disney's supposed to make their money, right? It's the summer of 1994. We're going to look at the three films in particular, and we'll start in chronological order with The Lion King. It was released on June 15th, only limited to two screens, yet it still finished in 10th place with $1.6 million, a ridiculous per-screen average of $793,000 per screen. Again, if you can make 10 grand per screen, that's a really, really good thing. And they made 793. The other films that it opened against were Wolf, which finished in first place, and getting even with Dad, Macaulay Culkin film, in fifth place. The only Disney films that were on the chart were the two films we talked about on our last episode from Touchstone Pictures. Renaissance Man was in seventh place. When a Man Loves a Woman was in 11th place. In its second week, it goes wide to 2,500 screens, and it begins its dominance. It finishes in first place with $40.9 million. It stays in first for the July 4th weekend, then drops down to second in its fourth week of release, following Forrest Gump hitting theaters. In its fifth week, it gets bumped down to number three with the release of True Lies, then down to fourth the week after with the release of The Client. By the end of July, it's still in the top five. It's still grossing nearly $10 million in its sixth week of wide release. The only real new hit that was dropped into theaters around that time would have been the Jim Carrey film, The Mask. For the entire month of August and into Labor Day, we're looking at five separate weekends, The Lion King remains in either seventh or eighth place. And these are the movies that came out against it. Clear and Present Danger, The Little Rascals, and a couple of Disney movies we're going to talk about in our next episode, In the Army Now, Color of Night, Natural Born Killers. Not a stiff competition, and it kind of stays steady for that whole time. It finally drifts off the box office charts in September, presumably because everybody saw it, not because of any other competition. The movies that came out in September are films like Milk Money, Trial by Jury, The Next Karate Kid, and I love me some JCVD, but Time Cop. Time Cop's good, but... yeah, that was one of the September releases. The film does get re-released back into theaters in November and stays on the charts all the way into February. Now, I don't want to go into that because we'll go into more details on that second run when we discuss the films that Disney put out at that same time. But I will just say that The Lion King goes on to gross $312.8 million in its entire theatrical run, which was good enough for number two on the year-end box office chart. Forrest Gump just couldn't top that. But the budget of the film was only $45 million, so I'd say that's quite a hit. To analyze the box office, I mean, again, like we talked about with the discussion of the movie, what else is there to say about the box office? This movie featured the magic of Disney animation. It's one of the absolute classics of the genre. It was released at the height of their powers, following that string of Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. The movie appeals to all ages, which is probably how you would explain why it holds up so well against all the summer competition that it faced. You know, and as far as family films, it gets a month-long buffer after the release of The Flintstones, and all of the other family films that come out the summer 1994 did not come close. I mentioned Getting Even with Dad. Here's what else we got. You got Little Big League, Baby's Day Out, Lassie, North, Black Beauty, Andre, Corinna, Camp Nowhere, which is a Hollywood Pictures film, and then I mentioned The Little Rascals is the only one that even kind of does at all that summer. And so, you know, maybe it was perfectly timed to be an alternative for those summer action movies, but people kept watching it. And then re-releasing it on the holidays was even more genius.
Like you said, I think this, you know, was the apex point of the resurgence of Disney animation. You had Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and then Lion King. And those four films just, you know, they brought in the family audience. And, you know, like we said, Lion King is Hamlet. And who doesn't love Shakespeare, especially when it's performed by animals?
Well, yeah. And like I said, and it doesn't matter how old you are, you probably saw. I mean, I didn't see it because I always joke it came out in that time between after I graduated high school and before I went off to college. And I didn't go to the theater a lot. And I guess I thought, oh, that's just a kid's animated movie. I would have been 17 years old. But you probably saw it in the theater, didn't you?
I did. I actually remember the night that I went and saw it, too. So, can't remember anything about I Love Trouble, but I can tell you the like what happened right before I went off to the theater for that night to see The Lion King. Much more memorable.
Well, let's go right into I Love Trouble. That movie was released on June 29th, which was a Wednesday. You know, it's so funny. I got to bring that up real quick. When I'm trying to do the research on, like, what was the exact release dates, it gets very, especially when the summer movies, it can be a little bit tricky because sometimes the movies come out on a Wednesday or a Friday. Box Office Mojo says one thing, IMDb says another, Wikipedia says another. A lot of times I think I have the date, and then I'll go pull the clip of the TV commercial, and at the end it'll say, oh, coming soon on the June 29th, the theaters. I'm like, ah, oh, I had it as July 1st, and I got to go back and change it. So, yeah, I Love Trouble, June 29th, a Wednesday. That weekend, it finished fifth at the box office with $7.8 million. The other films that it opened against were The Shadow, which finished in second, Blown Away, which finished fourth, Baby's Day Out, which was ninth, and Little Big League, which was 10th. The Lion King was in first place with $34 million, and there's no other Disney film on the chart at the time. In its second week, it drops to sixth following the release of Forrest Gump, which that's the movie that knocked Lion King off of the number one spot. It stays in sixth for its third week, even with two new releases, True Lies, which finished first, and Angels in the Outfield, which finished fourth. It finishes ninth in its fourth week, and then it just drops off the charts. It only grosses $30.8 million in its entire theatrical run, which would be, you know, halfway decent for a touchdown film. The problem was the budget was $45 million. from an analysis standpoint, again, we talked about it as before. Is it a romance or a mystery? Is it a suspense thriller or a bubbly comedy? And I'm wondering if maybe audiences probably couldn't decide, so they mostly avoided the film. I was looking at this. The top four of the July 4th weekend was Lion King, and then three action movies, The Shadow, Speed, and Blown Away. And so, you know, I'm impressed that it held the same spot from in its second to its third week. But I think that says more about The Shadow and Blown Away. You know, I can appreciate Disney trying to put this star vehicle at the height of the summer. But I don't think they knew how to market it. I think I was reading that like they thought they had a comedy and then they started marketing it as a suspense thriller. If you watch the commercials on YouTube, yeah, it's just it's like this dark movie about this journalist who's running for her life, right?
Off of that comment, I found a clip from Entertainment Tonight from 1994, like after the summer season, and they were talking about how much Hollywood had made at the box office, but also how many movies had bombed at the box office, or flopped, I should say, maybe not bombed. And they had an interview with Peter Travers, the Rolling Stone film critic. And he made some interesting points where he said Hollywood was making more money than ever before, but also flopping badly on Sure Things, which you would think I Love Trouble is. Uh-huh. But then he says almost 70 movies were released during the summer. And
wow.
You know, I think that's too much competition. And it got me thinking, I wonder how many movies now are being released, because it seems, you know, like every weekend there's the next big thing. Like, you aren't seeing a lot of normal box office for the last 10 years or so. You don't see a lot of month-long box office runs. It's like 1 or 2 weeks, and then the next thing's in. 1 or 2 weeks, you know. So yeah, I think Hollywood had just gotten to a point where they were kind of cannibalizing their own audience for sake of – it was quantity over quality.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting to think about. Like, I mean, I guess this was the July 4th weekend, but there are five movies that opened that weekend, and these are all studio pictures, too. And I feel like you just don't see that as much anymore. Everybody kind of bows to another studio. Yeah. They say, oh, you got that coming out. Well, we'll wait till next weekend to drop our movie, you know? And what's funny, like we mentioned, that summer movie, you used to think about these big action movies, and I feel like Disney does – there's a term we always use when we talk about our box office on this show, and that's counter-programming. And you know, Disney had these family films to sort of counter-program those action films. And Lion King and Angels in the Outfield both did halfway decent, and it almost served to kind of sink I Love Trouble as well, yeah. Speaking of Angels in the Outfield, that movie was released on July 15th. It finished fourth place with $8.9 million. The other film that it opened against was True Lies. That was all the way up in first. The Disney films on the chart, Lion King was in third, I Love Trouble was in sixth. The film drops to fifth in its second week following the release of The Client. Then it goes from seventh and then in down into ninth as we roll into August. It gets new films such as The Mask, It Could Happen to You, Clear and Present Danger, and The Little Rascals, another family film that it had to go up against. And we'll talk about that in a second. Angels in the Outfield hangs on through August in 10th place, Then it drops down to 14th place following a few new Disney releases. Again, we'll discuss them on the next episode. Before it drops off the box office charts after 6 weeks, but it grosses $50.2 million in its entire theatrical run. Good enough for 26th on the year-end chart. The budget was $31 million, so it may not have broken exactly even, but still, $50 million ain't so shabby. You know, and I think if you want to break that down, I'll say that this was a baseball film that was released during baseball season while no other sports movies were in theaters. And it also kind of dropped into this family film void. If you think about the fact that, like, other than The Lion King, all you had was Baby's Day Out, which had already been in theaters for a few weeks, and The Flintstones, which had already been in theaters for 2 months. You know, I mentioned Lassie and North when we were talking about Lion King. They don't provide much competition either, as neither one of those films finished ahead of Angels in the Outfield. I don't know if I would consider The Mask a family film, but to me, the real dagger for the theatrical run of Angels in the Outfield was the release of Little Rascals. I did see that that movie went on to gross $52 million, which put it four places higher on the year-end chart at number 22. But Angels in the Outfield did have a nice three-week head start on that film, and it made decent money by the time it ran its course as the summer ended.
I know that I gave the answer to this question away earlier, but do you know which one of those movies I saw in the theater?
You saw Little Rascals in the theater.
I did.
Yeah, it's funny to think about that movie doing as well as it did, considering that I know we're all about IPs and remaking things, but I mean, Little Rascals? I mean, that would have been 50 years old at that time, right? Who knew it? Well, we always like to look at the awards considerations for these films. One of them's got a lot to talk about, so I'm going to try to get through these as quick as I can. It, you know, The Lion King, it won a lot of stuff. It got four Oscar nominations, including three in the Best Original Song category for Hakuna Matata, Circle of Life, and the winner was Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Hans Zimmer also won Best Original Score. Now, Hans Zimmer's score and Can You Feel the Love Tonight also won Golden Globes, and the film won the Golden Globe for Best Picture, Musical, or Comedy. It wins Top Soundtrack at the American Music Awards and gets six Grammy nominations, winning three of them for Best Instrumental Arrangement with Accompanying Vocals. That was the, I guess you'd call it a mashup, Circle of Life and Nants Ingenyama. It wins for Best Musical Album for Children. Didn't realize that was a category. And Elton John wins Best Male Pop Vocal Performance for Can You Feel the Love Tonight? The Lion King also wins Favorite Movie at the Nickelodeon's Kids Choice Awards and Best Family Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy at the Young Artist Awards. It gets two MTV Movie Award nominations, Best Song for Can You Feel the Love Tonight? It loses to Big Empty by Stone Temple Pilots from the movie The Crow. I forgot. I mean, that song's great. The Crow's got a great soundtrack. I totally forgot that was in that movie. And then Jeremy Irons is also nominated as Best Villain, but he loses to Dennis Hopper in Speed, another great villain. Angels in the Outfield does get some award nominations. Milton Davis Jr., who played the character of JP, he was nominated for a Young Artist Award for Best Performance by an Actor Under 10 in a Motion Picture. He loses to Haley Joel Osment, who sees dead people in Forrest Gump, or maybe not in that movie, but he does go on to see dead people later in a movie that was produced by Disney. Yeah. All right, so as I always like to do on this show, like look at the films we discussed and figure out if they would fit into Jeffrey Katzenberg's ideal for singles and doubles for Touchstone Pictures and Walt Disney. I don't think so, Chad. I feel like I Love Trouble is an example of what not to do. It was these big stars. It was a July 4th weekend. And it feels to me like we've discussed it on how many episodes now that Touchstone was created to take chances on actors that weren't demanding higher salaries. And this movie just seemed like it was a bad idea. I kind of wish they would have let another studio deal with it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it probably would have affected the box office that much, but I Love Trouble feels more like a Hollywood Pictures than a Touchstone Pictures.
Maybe, and I the whole time I was watching it, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of Dick Tracy. Hmm. You know, like another big kind of summery movie where it was like, Touchstone was kind of started. When you think about what those early movies were, right? Down and Out in Beverly Hills and Ruthless People and Good Morning Vietnam and Dead Poets Society. And, you know, even Can't Buy Me Love, or we talk about Hello Again, you know. But then Dick Tracy was the one where they were just like, okay, now we're going to try to get into the summer movies because, you know, Disney wasn't doing as much. I mean, I guess Little Mermaid was, what, 89? So Dick Tracy would have been right after. And that was like they realized, hey, we can make hits with our animation. And we saw it with The Lion King. And so it's like, but why did you do I Love Trouble? That could have been like I said, it didn't, I don't even know why they did it. But hey, at least the Disney movies that they put out that summer did okay for themselves, especially The Lion King, yeah. Well, if you want to watch these movies at home, where would you find them? Well, I Love Trouble, streaming on Hoopla Digital, the streaming service from the public library. The Lion King is on Disney Plus, not a sponsor. But unfortunately, Angels in the Outfield isn't streaming anywhere. I had to get the DVD from the public library. Chad, you said you bought it online?
Yeah, I bought it on Amazon for $3. Brand new.
Okay. Well, maybe you can go donate. We can have a... I'm not ready to do giveaways just yet for movies that aren't Touchstone. But yeah, I wonder if we could donate it back to the library and more people can get a chance to see it. Because, you know, it's not so bad. So what are we looking at on our next episode? I was just going to say, you know, just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, we are going to look at the films that were released in August of 1994 by Touchstone and Hollywood Pictures. And the Hollywood Pictures, not so bad, but the Touchstone movie we're going to talk about is one of the biggest flops that was ever released by the studio. Wait until you see the box office numbers, Chad. It is mind-boggling how bad that movie did. Mm. What movie are we going to talk about? You know, you're just going to have to tune in next time to find out. My name is Mike DeKalb. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Mike DeKalb. Again, I think I mentioned on the last episode, my Twitter presence is getting scaled back significantly. I also run the Out of Touchstone Twitter account, which is at Out of Touchstone. But you can find me on Instagram. I'm on both of those. I got an Out of Touchstone Instagram account. If you want to shoot me an email, outoftouchstone@gmail.com. My co-host, Chad Smart, you can find him on Twitter at Chad Smart. This is June and July of 1994. Two hits, one flop. Do you have any final words to say?
I'm just going back to your lack of Twitter presence. You still never responded to my eBay link that I sent you where you could buy Cabin Boy for 1 cent. I think you need to get back on Twitter so you can see important stuff like that.
Now, I think that's reason enough not to get back on there. This is Out of Touchstone, and we're out of time. You're out of touch. I'm
out of time. Out of Touchstone is a Honey Nerds production. For more information, go to outoftouchstone.com. Be sure to follow at Out of Touchstone on Instagram and Twitter. And also, please like, subscribe, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for listening.
So, you're cool, I'm cool, we're cool. Thank you. Good night.
A young reporter has her eye on the Kate... Take two.